Radio Prague News.
A Prague court has sentenced an Israeli citizen to 5 years in prison for a grenade attack in the city in 2004. The woman at the center of a bizarre adoption case says she succeeded in making psychologists and doctors believe she was a 13-year-old girl. And the Czech Republic have been knocked out in the group stage at football's European Under-21 Championships. A Prague court on Monday sentenced an Israeli citizen to 5 years in prison for a grenade attack in the center of the city 3 years ago. Yaakov Mashailov is expected to be transferred to a prison in Israel. That was a condition of his extradition to the Czech Republic. Mashailov, who was born in Russia, threw a grenade under the jeep of the owner of a casino on Napřikope Street in the middle of the day. 17 people were likely injured in the attack, most of them foreign tourists. Barbara Škrlová, who is 32, says she succeeded in making psychologists and doctors believe she was a 13-year-old girl. In a newspaper interview, Škrlová also said she appeared before a judge during adoption proceedings, pretending to be a girl of 13 called Anička. This contradicts earlier reports that the woman who adopted her, Klára Maurová, switched the daughter of a family friend for Škrlová for the court hearing. Klára Maurová and her sister Kateřina are in custody on charges of abusing the former's 7-year-old son, Andrej. After it came to light that Andrej was being kept in horrendous conditions, the bizarre story of the attempted adoption slowly emerged. The family is believed to have been involved in a religious sect. A Brno police investigator who last week was charged with distributing child pornography has now been charged with the production and possession of drugs. Homemade opium was found during a search of the 41-year-old officer's home, said a spokesperson for the Brno police. A waitress at an internet cafe alerted the police after the investigator left a USB memory stick containing pornographic images of children in one of its computers. The Interior Ministry is now investigating the officer, who was on the force for 10 years. The Czech Republic have been knocked out in the group stage at football's European Under-21 Championships in the Netherlands. The Czechs were beaten 3-1 by Italy on Sunday evening, but even a win wouldn't have been enough to see them into the semi-finals, as England beat Serbia in the other group game, meaning both of those teams went through. Failure to advance also means the Czech Republic will not appear at next year's Olympic Games. Finally, the weather is set to remain rather overcast, with the chance of storms in the coming days. Temperatures will reach up to 32 degrees Celsius. My name is Ian Willoughby. You'll find more stories at radio.cz. But for now, that's the end of the news.
This is Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Jan Wellinger. Coming up today, we look at the curious story of 32-year-old Barbara Škrlová and 13-year-old Anička, one and the same person sought by Czech police. The weekend saw museum night in Prague. Our reporter was there. Also, a little later, you'll have a chance to meet Klára Poláčková, who at 28 recently became the first Czech woman to successfully climb Mount Everest. That and more in the next half hour. Last Friday, a woman named Barbara Škrlová walked into the Czech embassy in Denmark. Accompanied by her father and lawyer, she asked for a Czech passport and presented samples of her hair and saliva for DNA testing. The 32-year-old woman claimed to be a 13-year-old girl known as Anička, who police have been looking for since she disappeared from a children's home over a month ago. Dita Asiedu reports.
In early May, an 8-year-old boy was found by chance bound and naked in a broom cupboard. He, his brother and their 13-year-old adopted sister, Anička, were taken to a children's home. Since then, their single mother, Klara Maurova, and her sister, Katerina, have been in custody on child abuse cases. But this investigation has been overshadowed by another linked mysterious case. The 13-year-old Anichka, who was legally adopted earlier this year, turned out to have no identity. There were no official records of her having ever existed. A few days later, the girl disappeared off the face of the earth. After someone recognized her as 32-year-old Barbora Škrlova, DNA tests confirmed that the little girl was in fact an adult woman. On Friday, Barbora Škrlova finally turned up in Denmark. In an exclusive interview for the Czech daily Lidové noviny, she explained that she first invented little Anička at a scout camp. Since she found it difficult to get used to the life of an adult, she often escaped by being with children and sometimes pretending to be a child herself. Barbora Škrlova says she met Ondrej and Jakub Mauer, who later became her adopted brothers, at one of the scout camps, and they later became best friends. She already knew their aunt Katerina, as they had worked together in a children's home in the Moravian town of Brno. In the interview, she speaks about both her adult self and 13-year-old Anička in the third person, and her behavior shifts between that of a child and that of an adult.
I never had a problem managing both lives, that of Anička and that of Barunka. Now that Anička no longer exists, it is much harder for me. I'll see what the people will do with me. I do not trust people and feel no need to make any contact with them, only with those who I know well.
When asked whom she misses in Brno, she mentions Katerina and Klara Maurova, little Jakub, but not little Ondra. Upon the question why, she says she finds it a shame that he did not tell the truth. He said that he was locked up for a year and God knows what else. But I know that it simply wasn't like that, she tells the paper. After she escaped from the children's home, Barbora Škrlova hid in the forest before she took a train to her relatives in Denmark.
As far as the Klokánek children's home is concerned, they made many mistakes there. When I got there, they said that I looked like a 9-year-old, but when it all happened, they started claiming that they suspected that I was much older. They also never admitted that they allowed me and Jakub to watch television. Jakub watched the news twice. When I heard in the news that Klara would be in prison for 8 years, I decided to leave.
Psychiatrists have been skeptical. While some say Barbora Škrlova needs to undergo psychiatric therapy, others believe that her two identities are part of a master plan to influence the child abuse investigation. Barbora Škrlova does not intend to return to the Czech Republic. She says she fears the reaction of the media and of the general public.
Let's move to our second story now. Dusk on Saturday belonged to almost 50 museums and galleries in Prague, which opened at 7 p.m. for the fourth year of what is called Museum Night. Their treasures were, for one night only, on display free of charge, or in some places for a symbolic admission fee, opened until as late as 1 a.m. Well over 100,000 people turned out. Among them was Dita Salavova.
The museum night sights ranged from the most prominent galleries in the center, like Galleria Rudolfinum, currently exhibiting the paintings of Neo Rauch, all the way to various places on the outskirts, like, for example, Troja Chateau. Visitors had a chance to take guided tours or just question the tour guides present, like this one from the Spanish synagogue.
Well, people are interested about this building, about the architecture of this building. They are also interested about the present days of Prague Jewish community, about the services which synagogues are active. They are interested about the history of Prague Jewish community.
Thank you.
The exhibitions were joined by a number of accompanying events, such as the saxophone trio or the student orchestra's performance of Dvořák's Ninth Symphony from the New World. Michal Lukáš, the director of the National Museum, comments on the incredible number of culture lovers who flooded Prague.
Minulý ročník jsme zaregistrovali, my tomu říkáme 160 tisíc návštěvnických vstupů, protože my nejsme schopni spočítat návštěvníky.
Last year we registered 160,000 so-called visitor entrances, because we aren't able to count the visitors themselves, but we can count how many people enter a particular museum and base our estimate on this. Anyway, Prague gets crowded. 4 years ago we started with 8 to 12 buses, now we have 40 of them, and it's still not enough, so we'll probably have to increase the number next year again. Luckily the weather is nice, so one can go on foot as well.
At 11 p.m., the queues were still almost 100 meters long, and keen visitors heavily outnumbered the capacities of the sites. Nevertheless, the atmosphere was great. Natasha and Paula are from North Carolina.
Well, this is unique in its own. It's amazing to have a whole cultural infusion in one night. So I have not experienced something like this, which makes it even more the better.
We made a list. I know we want to go to the Military Museum next. And yeah, which is a little bit out there. So we'll see what we have time for after that.
Although there was no way to see even a quarter of the museums, some of them might become an inspiration for rainy weekends. The newly opened Charles Bridge Museum, for example, will certainly be worth it.
It's time for the latest sports news here on Radio Prague. And we start first with football. After losing to Serbia on a last-minute goal earlier in the week at football's under-21 European Championship in the Netherlands, things went from bad to worse for the Czech national squad on Sunday. The side was outshined and outplayed by Italy, who won the game 3-1. The Italians opened the scoring early, with the Czechs getting one back, their one goal of the tournament. But by halftime, Italy were up by 2. And that's the way it stayed until the final whistle. Not surprisingly, Monday's newspapers described the Czechs' early, if fully deserved, exit as disappointing. Their poor performance is doubly painful because it means they will now not have a chance to qualify for next year's Olympics. In other football news, star midfielder Pavel Nedved, who plays for Italian club Juventus, has not yet said whether he is planning to retire from professional football or continue next season. He has said he will make an announcement by the end of the month. The player, who won the Best European Player Award in 2003, was a major asset this year in helping Juventus move out of Italy's Serie B to return to the top flight. The player has made clear that even if he does retire, he and his family plan on staying in Italy, now home. Nedved has played there for 11 years, ever since making a splash at Euro 96, which saw him transfer first to Lazio Rome and later to Juventus. In tennis, the leading Czech men's tennis player Tomáš Berdych won his first tournament on grass at the weekend. The 21-year-old fourth seed beat last year's Wimbledon semi-finalist Marcos Baghdatis of Cyprus 7-5, 6-4 in the final at the Jerry Weber Open in Germany's Halle on Sunday. The win is Berdych's third ATP title. Experts say it should put the player in the right frame of mind for the upcoming Wimbledon. In other sports, 39-year-old kayaker Skipanka Hilgertová has become the oldest European competitor to ever clinch a medal in the kayak slalom. At the weekend, she managed to snag bronze in the event at the European Championships held on the artificial slalom course at Liptovský Mikuláš in neighboring Slovakia. Hilgertová was not the only Czech to finish with a medal. In the men's team canoe event, Jaroslav Wolf and Ondřej Skipanek won silver. And finally, star goalie Dominik Hašek has indicated he would like to come back for another season with the Detroit Red Wings. At 42, Hašek is one of the oldest goalies to ever play at top form in the NHL, but as last year's regular and post-seasons proved, he remains in excellent shape. He helped the Red Wings this year advance far in the Stanley Cup. He has one to his name, which he won with the Red Wings in 2002, but he has said he would like to try for another. That's the end of the sport. Let's move on now to our main feature for this day, which is One-on-One with Ian Willoughby.
Little over a month ago, Klára Poláčková was on top of the world, literally, as she became the first Czech woman to ever reach the peak of the world's highest mountain, Mount Everest. Klára, who is 28, is now back home in Prague and told me all about her incredible experience when we met the other day at a city centre cafe. But first, she told me a wee bit about her background.
I've been born in Prague, so right by the river, actually, so that's my home city. But for the last 4 years, I've been living in London in the UK, so I'm coming back home again now and trying to settle down a bit again.
What did you do in London?
That was a mixture. I started in the advertising agency, and after a while, when you get tired of the environment and you need a bit of a change and also a professional change, I started to work for the Department for Constitutional Affairs and then for the Ministry of Health.
How did you first get into climbing?
Climbing, I think more when did I first get to the mountains, which is something I'm very, which is my first sport and my great love. When I was small, my parents were taking me up to tiny mountains in Czech Republic, and then we started to go skiing more towards the Alps, and you started to discover a bit higher peaks, and then more recently, more towards the climbing, that came more about 5 years ago, really, when I met a group of guys who were really crazy about this stuff, and they started to take me up with them, and I guess I just joined in, and it just got me completely.
How did you first get the idea of climbing Everest?
Everest came last year only. I've been climbing another 8,000 meter peak in the Himalayas, and I've been on Choyu before, which is 8,200 meters. And I've met a great guide there, Tashi Tenzing, who's at the time he was guiding us up to the peak, and we became really good friends. And after we climbed together this one, we got back to Kathmandu to this beautiful cafe on the top of the roof, and we're just thinking, okay, what next? And once you reach 8,000 meters for the first time and you succeed, you have this sort of like thinking, okay, so let's try a little higher. And then came the offer from Tashi saying, why don't we give it a go? Have you ever thought of Everest? And that's where it came for the first time, and that's how it started.
Just to digress for a second, your guide has a famous grandfather, I believe.
True, he's the grandson of Tenzing Norgay, who climbed in 1953 with Sir Edmund Hillary for the first time on Everest. So climbing is truly in his family, for sure.
What about the training and the preparations for climbing Everest? What did that involve?
I think that's got two parts to it. I think one is you need to be experienced enough from climbing before. You need to be used to the altitude. You have to know basic climbing techniques. And the second bit of it is your physical condition. So that was a harsh training for about 6 months, rather intensively, prior to the climbing.
When you actually did it, when you set off, how difficult did you find it in reality?
Very honestly, this was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And both physically and also psychologically, this is very difficult. Almost 2 months you spend on the mountain throughout the whole expedition. So it's been tough.
Did you ever have any particularly hairy moments or moments when you thought, I want to go back, I can't take this anymore?
I don't think that was a true crisis that came really, because otherwise I don't think we would have made it. But I think throughout the whole expedition you have moments when you just think, gee, it's just I'm fed up, I'm tired, I need a shower, I want a proper bed, I miss my blanket and stuff. So you have those moments when they come, and it's just the more important thing is to get over that. So
tell us about the actual summit itself when you reach the peak.
Summit day, that's pretty amazing, but to be honest, you're so tired and really exhausted, and as they say, getting to the top is just halfway. You also need to get down, which is the more difficult bit, to be honest. So we spent about half an hour on the summit. You look around and you see, thinking, gosh, all those peaks I see are actually lower than where I am now, which feels great, but it's pretty cold as well. It was about minus 30 up there, and my hands were completely frozen at the time, and I was just saying, God, we need to get down. So it's the moments of when you realize, I think that comes much, much later.
Was it at night when you reached the peak of Everest?
We actually started to climb in the evening. We started at 9 p.m. We climbed the whole night, and we reached the summit at 7 o'clock in the morning. And then, again, it takes another 6 or 8, up to 8 hours to get down again to Camp 2, which is sort of like a reasonable altitude where you can have a bit of a rest again.
I also read that you made a phone call from the peak of Everest, which certainly makes a change from I'm on the train. Who did you call, and what did you say?
We had a satellite phone with us, so I made a very quick phone call home to my sister saying that we are right, we're still up there. But from what I understood, when she spoke to me afterwards, she said actually that scared them quite a bit because I didn't sound like I'm having a great time up there. So they were a bit worried and waiting for another 8 hours before I'd called again saying I'm actually safe and down again. But yeah, I called home with my sister.
Did your fingers actually become frostbitten?
I had a little bit of trouble with my fingers, that's true. So a few of my fingers, you can still see. Well, the listeners can't see. But that's kind of coming back to normal again. It wasn't too serious, but it's the moments where you stop the feeling in the top of your fingers just is gone, pretty much.
When you were on Everest, a couple of days later, the mayor of Prague, Pavel Bem, also reached the peak. Did you meet him at all on your trip?
It was pretty close because I got a news via the satellite from Prague that it looks like that maybe he may be summiting on the same day, but he was climbing from the other side. I was climbing from the north face, the Tibetan side, and he was climbing south face from the Nepal. So there was a tiny chance that we may meet on the summit, which would be amazing, but I missed him by 2 days. But we met later, in fact, afterwards in Kathmandu, in a much nicer setting, in a small pub, and had a beer, and that was great.
You are the first Czech woman to ever reach the peak, but he is the mayor of Prague, he's already well known. Did he perhaps a little bit steal your thunder when he reached the peak just after you?
I don't think it's about stealing any thunders and stuff. That's not why you climb. I think the climbing is very individual and very personal experience in a way, so the whole sort of media coverage that has been created around it, it's just happening, but I don't care who's getting more or less coverage, that's not important.
Also around that time, a Czech climber died, a man called Libor Kozák. Were you aware that he had died?
This is very unfortunate thing that happened on the mountain, and that happens. I knew him, we met on the mountain, and we spent amazing 3 weeks together, and he was a really good friend, so It's not easy to talk about that. I learned the fact that he died up there the second day after we reached the summit, when we were getting down from North Col, and a member of another expedition who was closer to him at the time told me that this happened. So this is very unfortunate.
Generally speaking, what's the atmosphere like between climbers when you're in the base camp or halfway up the mountains, so to speak?
I think it's generally very friendly, to be honest. I mean, everyone is there, everyone is suffering, everyone is sort of on the same wave trying to get ready and hopefully try to summit at some point of during their expedition. So when you're in the base camp, it's sort of a small village where people meet. If you're not in the phase when you're actually climbing up there, you have a lot of time to walk around other camps and talk to other expedition members. So that's fantastic. That's really nice.
I've read often and heard often that Everest these days can be quite crowded, and also that there's lots of rubbish around the place. Is that true?
About the rubbish bit, no. I have to say, but that was a very pleasant surprise, to be honest, because that's what I've heard before as well. When we got there, I think now every expedition that goes up the mountain is very responsible in this respect and knows that whatever they bring with them, they also take away when they leave. So I think this has changed a lot, and the mountain has been also cleaned a lot. There was a Japanese expedition, in fact, which been doing this for the last few years, that they've been coming towards the end of the season, and their aim was not to climb to the top, but it was actually to take away the rubbish from the mountain. And they've been doing this for a long time, and this year I spoke to the guy towards the end, and he said, I feel that my mission is finished, because this is the last year we're doing this, and I don't feel the need that this is needed anymore, because the mountain is pretty much clean, and people are responsible and don't leave the rubbish behind anymore. So I think this is great now.
After this long and rather intense experience, did it take you long to get used to normalcy again, to normal life? And also, I'm curious, what did you most enjoy when you came back to civilization?
The second bit is pretty easy. I think as every girl, I kind of you like to sort of, like, a bit of a hygiene is missing on the mountain. So the thing I was really, really missing was my first shower. So after we got back to Kathmandu, I got to the hotel and I was like, I think I spent there almost an hour just standing there and the water kept dropping all over it. I'm just like, this is great. And getting back to the normal world again, I think that that's part of the whole thing. Like, for a while you're climbing and then you get back to, you can't escape, and I need to get back to my normal living. I miss my family, I miss my friends, so, and it's great to be in Prague in summer, so I think the entry is not too bad.
You've just moved back to Prague. What's next for Klára Poláčková?
Next is to finally unpack. I still have boxes all over from that we moved over from London. I didn't have time to do that. And a little bit of traveling around Czech Republic and maybe going downwards somewhere to the sea and just relax. And towards the end of summer, I think I'll be looking for another professional sort of challenge and find something new that I will enjoy work-wise.
One-on-One with guest Klára Poláčková on her Everest climb and more was produced by Ian Willoughby. I'm Jan Wellinger. That's all we have time for today. Please join us again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.